Well, our discussions this morning will be mostly on the Exodus, especially as relates to the memorial upcoming. And Land has brought several of these illustrated synopses of various books of the Bible. It's out on the table in the dining area. This one is on the Exodus. Very appropriate to our discussions this morning. But first, what is the first suggestion we have in the Scriptures concerning that which we memorialize? And I think we find that actually before the Exodus, we find it in Genesis chapter 40. Verses 1 to 22, and we won't take time for reading those. But I think perhaps we will recognize the case where Joseph was unjustly put in prison, and he was apparently there for a couple of years when the Pharaoh had reason to suspect his butler or his baker. And it took him about 3 days to hold a trial about it. But he put the butler and the baker in the king's prison where Joseph was. Now, my guess would be that what he got was some kind of ptomaine poisoning, like the 24-hour ptomaine poisoning. And therefore, the logical people to suspect would be the one who made the food or the one who served the food, the baker and the butler. Well, the two of them were put into prison. Joseph talked to them. They said each that they had a dream the previous night. And one had a dream of three branches with grapes on them, clusters of grapes. And he was able to squeeze the grapes into the cup for Pharaoh. The baker had three baskets of white bread on his head, and the birds came and ate up the bread. And Joseph interpreted it. I don't know how many of us would have been wise enough to think that three branches would represent 3 days, or that three baskets of white bread would represent 3 days, but evidently the Lord showed that to Joseph. But the thought of the grapes and the grape juice and the thought of the bread are perhaps our first suggestion of the memorial emblems. We won't carry that much further, except to say that one seemed to be unto life and the other seemed to be unto death. Now let's consider the Exodus and its relationship to the memorial. There's an overall broad picture starting around the 7th chapter of Exodus and going through 15, at least the first part of the 22nd verse. And that is a case of when Moses comes to Egypt, the plagues and so forth begin, and then Israel is ultimately delivered. And they wind up eventually going the 3 days' journey in the wilderness, which is what they asked to do in the very first place. And Pharaoh is kind of a slow learner, but he eventually gets the message to let them go. But overall, that is a type. We won't go into much detail on the plagues, except that it's to say at this point, it is a type. Moses comes to Egypt like Jesus' first advent. And then we go through the period of the plagues, the present evil world, throughout the gospel age. They get delivered from Egypt to go out to the edge of the desert. That's the millennium where they're free from the influence of Pharaoh or Satan. And then there's Satan's little season where they're apparently trapped at the Red Sea or Reed Sea. But they go, the Lord's people are delivered, and Pharaoh and his hosts are drowned once and for all, because at the end of the little season, Satan, as well as all his hosts, including human hosts, will be destroyed once and for all. And then they go 3 days' journey in the wilderness. A little technical thing. Most translations that I have seen, not all, most say 3 days' journey into the wilderness. But that's not really the preposition that the Hebrew uses. It's being. It simply means in, within. So it can be whether they go straight into the towards the center of the wilderness or they go along near the edge of the wilderness. Either is allowable. But it's 3 days' journey in the wilderness to serve the Lord their God, to do the sacrifice that they had asked to do in the first place. And that would represent the full kingdom of God, which continues after the little season throughout all the ages of eternity. Now, sometimes we talk about not only the Passover, when they sacrifice the Passover lamb, but also the feast of the Passover, the 7-day feast of the Passover. I won't bother much with when it begins, whether it's the middle of the 14th or the beginning of the 15th. That's not too relevant here, except that it's as a 7-day feast of Passover. There are 3 days that they have an encampment. 3 times they have an encampment until they get to the edge of the sea. Now, after the second one, they take an interesting turn, a surprising turn, which is what gives the Pharaoh his opportunity to go after them, figuring that, well, the Lord really wasn't with them in the first place. Well, those 3 days would represent the millennial kingdom. But why 3 days? Well, first of all, I do not know. But a reasonable supposition, at least, is the first day would be the 100 or 200 years that it takes to get everybody up out of the grave in the first place. And then the second would be continuing the restoration of people to human perfection. And then the third one, there's some kind of an unexpected turn which later gives Satan his opportunity to deceive those whom he can once again. And that will be for the final exam, which we refer to as Satan's little season. And that would be represented by day 4, where they cross the sea. And then days 5, 6, and 7, to the end of the Feast of Passover, bring us through into the perfect ages of eternity. Now, they're to have a holy convocation on the first day of the Feast of Passover, and then they're to have a holy convocation on the last day of the Feast of Passover. I think it's easy enough to make a reasonable guess as to what that first day of holy convocation is. The first day when they're out from under the influence of Pharaoh, that's when the dead are coming back from the grave. How long will it take? Well, if we calculate it on the basis of the percentage of people that is coming back to Israel ever since Petah Tikva, it's about 2-4% of the Jewish population in Israel that comes back on average each year. And at that rate, even if you had cut the population down to just 1 billion, I doubt that it will be anywhere that low. But if it were just 1 billion, it would take only about 100 to 200 years to get everybody out of the grave again. So it seems reasonable, at least, to consider that may represent the resurrection of all the world's dead at the beginning of the millennium. And then we have that holy convocation on the seventh day, the last day of the feast of Passover. And that would be the third of the 3 days' journey in the wilderness. And presumably that's representing the celebration that the whole world will have going on forever without termination. Well now, we've got this broad overall picture. There are 10 plagues on Egypt. That's what it takes to persuade Pharaoh. As I say, he's kind of a slow learner. The first 3 plagues fall on the Egyptians and the Israelites alike. Moses doesn't administer them, Aaron does. But for the last 7 plagues, Moses takes the dominant role, and the plagues fall only upon the Egyptians. Moses takes the dominant role and begins the separation of the peoples. And to me, that would seem to represent that Christ at his return begins the harvest work of separation. Now then, we have something about the Passover, not at the beginning of the plagues or at the time that Moses comes to Egypt even. But it's not until the very last plague. This would seem to represent a bit of a quandary, because we think of the Passover. 1 Corinthians 5 confirms it. Christ, our Passover, is slain. That it looks like the Passover, in this case, begins only at the time of Armageddon, begins when the church is complete. How can that be? I think we should scratch our heads a bit on that. But I suggest that there is a reason that the Passover lamb is not slain until the last plague is as a reminder that for the deliverance of the people, we have to have first the work of Christ's first advent. Now, in Revelation, when we get right down to the last plague, then there's this statement that, "Behold, I come as a thief." And that seems a little surprising too, does it not? That his coming as a thief would not take place until the last plague? But now we see it's a reminder in Revelation that the work of Christ's second advent is necessary for the deliverance of the peoples. So in the Passover, in Exodus, we're reminded that the work of Jesus' first advent is essential to the deliverance of the people. And then in Revelation, that the work of Christ's second advent is necessary for the deliverance of the people. Now it says in Exodus chapter 12, which is where we'll spend most of our time from here on. Exodus chapter 12 and verse 46. It's talking about the Passover. In one house, 45, okay, now 46. In one house shall it be eaten. Thou shalt not carry forth aught of the flesh abroad out of the house, neither shall ye break a bone thereof. This is the ordinance of the Passover. Well, why does it suggest here that ye shall not break a bone of it? Do we think of anything in the New Testament that explains it? Oh, we'll look over. Yes, Teresa. That's right. We'll look at John chapter 19, verse 36. And John makes this point. I'll start with the 35th verse. And he that hath seen hath borne witness, and his witness is true, and he knoweth that he saith true, that ye also may believe. For these things came to pass that the scripture might be fulfilled, a bone of him shall not be broken. So here we have it typified with the Passover lamb, that not a bone thereof shall be broken. Now, is that true of all of the sacrifices? Well, we have a radically different example in Leviticus 9:13. Here we're talking about the burnt offering that follows in the sacrifice order. And that's, okay, we'll start with the 12th verse, Leviticus 9:12. And he slew the burnt offering, and Aaron's sons delivered unto him the blood, and he sprinkled it upon the altar round about, and they delivered the burnt offering unto him, piece by piece, and the head, and he burnt them upon the altar. This is quite a different situation. The sacrifice is dismembered, and then the members are put together with the head. Well, the only rational explanation I can think of for that is that it's talking here, and the burnt offering is representing Jesus and his body members, that they are apart and they are brought together with the head, Jesus being the head. So we need to look at the individual offering to determine which it is. But when it says, not a bone of his body shall be broken, John connects that specifically with the sacrifice of Jesus. Now, what was done with the lamb's blood? Now we go back to the early part of chapter 12. What was done with the lamb's blood? Okay, as we read that, it says, and they shall take of the blood and put it on the two side posts and on the lintel upon the houses wherein they shall eat it. Now, a lintel, that's not a word that we commonly use, is it? What is a lintel?
It's the header on a door frame.
That's right. And if we were to go over here to the wide doors, the lintel is the top part, and then we have the two side posts. What do you need the side posts for? Unless there's a lintel, it's the side posts are out there to hold up. What would be signified by the blood being sprinkled on the side posts and on the lintel? Okay, I see Teresa's hand.
You cannot enter into salvation unless you are protected by the blood of Christ.
That's good. And,
Land? Yeah, that's the ultimate significance, but the splashing of it in and of itself is a recognition or a sign that has been instructed. If one wants the salvation, they have to do something about it. This shows that they are harmonizing, an outward sign that they are on board with what they want.
Thank you. Now, this is a little side note, but it's a little over half a century ago that Richard Parker at University of Chicago discovered that in Egypt, which would be about this time, in Egypt they reckoned the beginning of the day as sunrise rather than sunset. that solves certain problems. But they were not to leave the house until the morning. They were to stay under the blood. As has been mentioned, the only way to gain the salvation is through the blood of Christ. And one must not come out again then, not until morning, when they're to leave Egypt. Now, we've got the blood sprinkled on the doorposts and on the lintel. Why was it not sprinkled on the threshold?
Probably because this was a Passover, and the whatever it was, the angel of death could see from above and on the lintel and on the side posts and pass over that house going on to the next.
Okay, thank you. And I see one more hand here.
It would not be appropriate to trample the blood. You do not trample the sacrifice of Christ. So that's why it could not be on the ground.
Okay, good. I think it is Hebrews 10:29 that seems to confirm that. I did write that down somewhere, yes. Hebrews 10:29. Starting with the 26th verse, it's giving us advice what not to do. And if we start with the 28th verse, a man that hath set at naught Moses' law dieth without compassion on the word of two or three witnesses. Of how much sorer punishment, think ye, shall he be judged worthy who hath trodden under foot the Son of God, and hath counted the blood of the covenant wherewith he was sanctified an unholy thing, and hath done despot unto the Spirit of grace. So we are to be under the blood. The blood is not to be under our feet. Now then, the Passover lamb, was to be a lamb of the first year. And some may reasonably question whether that means it was a newborn spring lamb or whether it's a lamb 1 year old. I won't say that I am positive of the answer of that. But it was to be roasted. This is now in verse 9. It was to be roasted and not sodden with water at all. What would be the significance of that, that you couldn't boil it, you had to roast it?
A fire is a purifier.
Okay. A fire is a purifier. And Dorothy.
And water might leach out some of the good part.
Okay, good. So, if it is to be roasted, then you don't keep the heat down. And for Jesus' sacrifice, did he shy away from the heat? He accepted the full amount of his sacrifice, and we benefit from that. Now, secondarily, there could have been a practical reason for it, too. Which way do you cook faster, roasting it or boiling it? That's right. More heat, less time. And did they have a lot of time to do their roasting? No, I think I've heard various estimates that it could take anywhere from 2 to 4 hours. They didn't have a lot more time than that. Of course, the question is, when was the Passover lamb to be slain? And there are three different views, because it says, literally, it's between the two evenings. And I expect that there will be a difference of thought on that. But the three views are, one, between the two evenings means, like the Sadducees said, between the time the sun sets and the stars come out. Or two, as the Pharisees said, that it's between, that there are two evenings that the afternoon is divided up into. And the first one would be noon to about three, and the other would be three to about sunset. And that between the two evenings would be around 3 o'clock. And the third view is that it is from one sunset to the following sunset. I do not think that the view of the mid-afternoon is tenable. In Exodus chapter 16, we have verses 12 and 13, where it says, I have heard the murmurings of the children of Israel speak unto them, saying, between the evenings ye shall eat flesh, and in the morning ye shall be filled with bread, and ye shall know that I am Jehovah your God. Now there, of course, is a contrast between the two evenings and the morning. In verse 13, it came to pass at even that the quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay round about the camp. Now, the quail come up at even, and they are to eat them, the quail, between the two evenings. Now, if between the two evenings meant in the middle of the afternoon, the migratory kind of quail don't settle down until the evening, because they don't want to be settling down at dark. They might be settling down in the midst of their enemies. So when the sun is going down, that's when the quail settle down. Now the quail coming up, well, they've come from the sea, the Red Sea, and they're coming to the Sinai Peninsula. They have to rise by several hundred feet at minimum. They'll be pretty tired by then, so it's maybe not too difficult for the Israelites to come take them one at a time. But they come up at even, and they eat them between the two evenings. It would be difficult to eat the quail before they came. So it would appear to me that between the two evenings means essentially between the time the sun goes down and the stars come out, between the two lights. And we have a similar word in the English language for two lights, and we call it twilight. And some of the translations use that. I realize, however, there are two different opinions in addition to that one. But it gives us a basis for saying we should partake of the memorial after sunset. Now then, it says that it should be eaten with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs. That's verse 8. With unleavened bread and with bitter herbs. Why should it be with unleavened bread?
Because leaven means bacteria, and bacteria are impurities.
Okay, it would be with yeast and land.
You might say it's a preservative. It's an inflated. It's like an inflated preservative, not the real substance itself.
Okay, good. Yeast is an element or means of corrupting. You have something that's puffy, it makes it easier to eat, no question about that. But what happens if you leaven the bread and you let it rise and you let it rise and you let it rise? eventually you get the idea that, hey, you don't want it to keep rising forever, because it just simply corrupts if you let it keep going and going and going. So the yeast or the leaven is an idea of a corrupting influence, and Paul confirms that in the Corinthians epistle. But now one more thing. Why were they to eat it with bitter herbs?
My memory tells me it is to be a culinary reminder of the bitterness of the bondage that they were in Egypt.
I think that's exactly the thought here. So, the significance for us is we should accept for our eating truth and only truth, not adjusted to our own conveniences. And also, we should accept the bitter experiences that come our way. Now then, James, I suppose you've taken a course in chemistry a time or two. Okay, was it all theory?
Not all, but mostly theory. Yeah.
Okay. What happened when you went into the lab?
Well, you would do a lab report usually. There would be a problem that you're supposed to solve usually with chemicals, and you're supposed to do some procedures and then find the what happens, then jot down notes on based on what happens, basically.
Did it always follow what the book said would happen?
No.
That's right. And that's part of the learning experience. That I think I've just about enough time to tell an experience I had with a junior college lab. That it was a course in qualitative analysis, I think it was. And I had this, what was called an unknown. And I started the procedure precipitating this, if it would, and then precipitating that with another reagent and so forth. And I got about part way through it, and I had an idea I might just have mercury. So I tried a little side experiment. And I went to the instructor and said, I think I have mercury. And that was great, because that was the right answer. All up until she asked, and how did you determine that it was mercury? And my face turned red. I put the unknown on a penny, and the copper went away because it was covered with mercury. However, the instructor said, actually, that is fine, because this is a course in chemistry, not out to make you technicians, but to make you think of how chemistry works. So, we need our laboratory experience. Think of some of the scriptures like in Romans. The trial of your faith. Okay, how about that? We need trials or tribulations, because tribulation works what? Works patience. Patience works experience. And experience works the hope that will leave us not ashamed. So we need our laboratory experience in this life. It is a definite necessity, a part of our training. And that would seem to be what's pictured then with accepting the bitter herbs along with the unleavened bread. Now, the Passover was to be eaten with haste. This is in verse 11 now. The Passover was to be eaten in haste, with shoes on and staff in hand. What does this tell us? What's the significance?
I liken it to theological fast food to go.
Okay, yes, that's right. The only reason for wording it similar to this is that they had to be ready to go at a moment's notice. How long do you think it was from the time that the sun came up until they started leaving Egypt? Just about. And why do you say that?
Because the morning was the time to travel. They couldn't see at night. And the rest of Egypt was waking to the realization and anger of their firstborn, and they would pursue very shortly.
Thank you. You can imagine with the firstborn in every house dead, even the firstborn of every animal dead. How long do we think that the Egyptians would let them stay in their land? Now we'll recall also that before the Passover night, they were to ask the Egyptians, whether you call it borrowing or just asking them, which is more literal, for this and that. And the Egyptians let them have what they wanted. Because after all, suppose you were one of the Israelites back then. Now, here come the Egyptians to say, just leave Egypt. Get out of here. Get out of here as fast as you can. Well, you want us to leave our lands, our houses here? We need some reparations for this. Well, the Egyptians would be glad to give them whatever price they wanted. Now, normally, if a whole people were to leave the country, there'd be a glut in the real estate market. But because of the haste with which the Egyptians wanted to get them out, the prices may have gone up. Just a little trivial aside, go back to the second of the seven last plagues, the murrain that killed the cattle in Egypt, but not in Israel. What do you suppose happened to the price of the cattle in Israel? And the Egyptians had to pay it to get their cattle back. And so it would have been with the plague of the hail that destroyed so many things. The Lord worked it out to the benefit of the Israelites. And ultimately, it will be to the benefit of the Lord's people. All the things that have happened during the gospel age. But if you go down to verses 31 to 39, what was the result of the Passover lamb? What was the result of that night?
Well, they were delivered from death from the angel of the Lord. They were saved.
That's right. So we understand the result of the slaying and eating of the Passover lamb was the deliverance of the people. Now, were the Egyptians delivered from Egypt? Oh.
When you say the, my understanding is only those who were to follow, and if they had to put blood on theirs as a result of hearing or gossip of this, they could be saved too, and that there was a vast mixed company accompanying Israel out of Egypt. There was probably a very select few, a remnant.
Thank you. And that's the point. There was this mixed multitude that went out with them. But Pharaoh's people, the ones that stayed, they would represent those who were on the side or in heart sympathy with Satan. But there is a mixed multitude then that will come out into the millennial kingdom. And when we think about our memorial observance, we want to focus attention on our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, his sacrifice for us, and on the result to the benefit not only of us, but of the whole world. Just a little bit of an aside. In 1 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, the King James says, Christ our Passover is sacrificed for us. But the earlier manuscripts don't mention the for us. That was added later. That Christ our Passover is sacrificed, and the benefit is not limited to us. It is for the benefit of the whole world. It will lead to the deliverance of all the world from sin, sickness, sorrow, and death. Now then, are there differences between the Passover at the time of the Exodus and the later Passover observances? And was it a good thing or a bad thing if there were any differences? There are a couple of significant differences. One of them was that every household in Egypt was to take a lamb for the family. And if the household was too small, then find another household that is too small and share the lamb between them. This was not to be the case for the subsequent Passovers when they entered into the land. There is, thou shalt not sacrifice the Passover within any of thy gates, but only at the place that Jehovah thy God shall choose. Well, where was that? The place that Jehovah thy God shall choose was the tabernacle until the temple was built. And once the temple was built, it was to be at the temple. Now, I have, over the years, had a good, friendly relationship with a Jewish friend. I continue to think well of him, though we're out of contact for a while. And I asked him one time, isn't it in the law that the Passover lamb is to be sacrificed each year? He says, yes, that's right, it is. And so I asked him, well, why is it then that Israel does not sacrifice the Passover lamb today, the Passover time, Nisan 14? And he answers quite correctly that, well, we can't because there is no temple. If the temple were rebuilt, then they figure they could. Then I just had to ask the next question. Yes. Why is it then that the temple was destroyed 40 years after Jesus' ministry began, unless Jesus is the Mashiach or Messiah? I want to think about that. I let it go at that point. A second difficulty on account of the temple and it being destroyed is, who today can trace his lineage back to David and to Abraham? He has to be the son of David. But who can do it? Because when the temple was destroyed, the genealogy was destroyed with it. And to my knowledge, no Jew today can trace his lineage back, whether it is to David or Judah or Levi or any of the other tribes of Israel. Yes.
Coming right up. There's one name we can. And that's Jesus. It's given to us in Matthew and Luke. That's the only name that's given by the genealogy.
That's right. That's the genealogy that has been preserved. Now there's a second difference, at least in my understanding, and that is as to when the Passover lamb was to be slain. And I will just offer this suggestion that it was my understanding that the Passover lamb was to be slain between the two evenings or at twilight. And at the time of Jesus, in fact, probably for centuries before that, they were no longer slaying it at twilight. They were slaying it at mid-afternoon. And there was a practical reason for it. Think, if you had a city like Jerusalem, and whether the population of it was 10,000 or 100,000, but you had 1 million people coming to partake of the Passover, what are you going to do with 1 million people in the size of the city of Jerusalem? Some of them have to go out into the suburbs. Jesus and his disciples did. So you don't really want to do that when you're getting late at night. Now, you got one thing in your favor. They could do it because the moon is full. But it's a lot more convenient if you can have the Passover lambs slain in the afternoon, and then you can get the people out to their places where they're going to be living overnight. But because that change was made, Jesus could have the Last Supper with the disciples at the time that the lambs were supposed to be slain in Egypt, while at the same time he would be the Passover lamb slain while the typical lambs were being slain in the mid-afternoon. So those are two differences between the Exodus Passover and the subsequent Passovers, and they each have a practical reason. And now we want to think, what are the lessons for the consecrated Christian? And I see our time is burning, so I'll try to summarize a little bit on this. The focus of the time of the Exodus is on the Passover lamb, the slaying of the Passover lamb. And the result of the slaying of the Passover lamb and its application is the deliverance of the Lord's people from the land of sin, sickness, sorrow, and death. And as far as that goes, one of the scriptures says that if you obey my laws, my commandments, then I will put upon you none of the diseases which I have put upon the Egyptians. Some of that, no doubt, had to do with not eating unclean animals, shellfish, other such things. Botulism wouldn't be a problem if people didn't eat shellfish, and so forth. So, the diseases were in Egypt to a greater extent than they were when Israel was out in the wilderness. So we focus our attention upon Jesus, our Passover lamb, and also look forward to what it brought about, which was the deliverance of all the Lord's people from the kingdom of sin, sickness, sorrow, and death.